This is VOA News via remote. I'm Diane Roberts. A SpaceX rocket carrying two Americans has docked with the International Space Station, the first commercial launch to take U.S. astronauts into space. It's also the first time in almost a decade a U.S. rocket has lifted off carrying American astronauts to the International Space Station. The SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket, with the Dragon capsule aboard, launched into orbit from Kennedy Space Center Saturday. This morning, Americans are still processing what happened following protests over the death of George Floyd. Floyd, an African-American, died Monday while in the custody of white Minneapolis police officers. Nationwide, police have arrested people in almost two dozen U.S. cities, according to the Associated Press. The National Guard was called up in about a dozen states and the District of Columbia. They deployed outside the White House. You can hear law enforcement firing pepper spray as crowds taunted officers. In New York City, dangerous confrontations flared repeatedly as officers made arrests and cleared streets. In Philadelphia, at least 13 officers were injured when peaceful protests turned violent and at least four police vehicles were set on fire. In Los Angeles, the governor declared a state of emergency and ordered the National Guard to back up the city's police officers. The police chief said they helped control the situation.
We go to locations, we secure it, we even make arrests, and then only to have to come back to the location because others come in behind us. So this is going to allow us to hold ground at hundreds of locations and without taxing our police resources, which will allow us to go out and ensure the safety of communities.
From Washington via remote, this is VOA News. The protests have sent shudders through the health community and elevated fears the huge crowds will lead to a new surge in cases of the coronavirus. The number of cases worldwide has topped 6 million Sunday, according to a running tally by Johns Hopkins University. Nearly 370,000 people have died from the virus, almost 104,000 of them in the hardest-hit country, the United States. The U.S. has nearly 1.8 million confirmed infections, while the world pushes toward 6.1 million cases. Nearly 2.6 million people have recovered from the respiratory illness. Latin American countries brace for difficult weeks ahead as the disease spreads rapidly across the region while much of the world exits lockdowns. Brazil registers another record surge in daily infections as divisions deepen among leaders on how to deal with the pandemic, thus hampering efforts to slow the virus. Brazil lags only behind the United States in confirmed cases. Restaurants, cafes, and bars in Paris will be able to put more tables outside when they reopen Tuesday after 2 months of lockdowns. Inside dining rooms must remain closed, though. The mayor told a paper, "In this crisis, Paris needs to support its restaurants and bars. They are the heart of our city." The high number of COVID-19 cases and higher contagion risks in the densely populated Paris region prompted authorities to allow only limited operations for now. Restaurants across other areas of France can fully reopen Tuesday. For hundreds of Belgians hoping to spend time with French friends and relatives after almost 3 months of lockdown, the sunny holiday weekend proved a grim disappointment. While families with ties in the Netherlands, Germany, and Luxembourg were able to put the coronavirus epidemic out of their minds for a short while, the French border remained shut. Belgian travelers without written proof they were on essential business were turned back by French police, despite an announcement from their own government that reunions and shopping trips can resume. Greece may be a top vacation destination, but for the British, Americans, and Italians dreaming of getting away, the country will be off limits for some time. The government in Athens has left them off a list of 29 countries from which Greece will start accepting visitors as it scrambles to mitigate the damage the COVID-19 pandemic has spelled for its biggest money-making industry, tourism. Greek tourism officials say travelers from the permitted countries will be able to enter Greece beginning June 15th, allowed to touch down only at the capital's main international airport and the northern metropolis of Thessaloniki, not other sun-kissed destinations. And global sports has started to rev back into action with Austria announcing it will host Formula One's delayed season opener July 5th and the NBA eyeing a July 31st return. Britain approved the return of domestic competitive sports June 1st, but with no fans present. Via remote, Diane Roberts, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
We are saying they can end the lockdown, but we are not going to be what you call guinea pig for them. And we are not going to be sacrificial land for them to open the economy. If they want to open their economy, fine, let them do it. But schools must remain closed until September.
The Teachers Union of South Africa tells its members to defy the government's order to reopen schools beginning Monday.
If a person is suspected of having committed any crime, it shall be the duty of the police officers to investigate such persons and bring them before the court of law to be formally charged and ultimately prosecuted.
The Lesotho police say they will arrest a former first lady when she returns from an overseas trip.
How can people say that a person like Mr. Gbagbo, who is working for reconciliation, even from his prison cell, can be accused of being probably or eventually the cause of trouble in Cote d'Ivoire? This is mere political speculation.
And supporters of former Ivorian President Laurent Gbagbo are excited about the prospect of his return to the country. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The South African government has issued an order for schools to be reopened next week. But the Educators Union, or UESA, says members of the group should defy the order and not return to the classrooms. The group also called on parents not to send their children to school as originally scheduled to reopen on June 1. Sifiwe Mungose, General Secretary of UESA, says the government appears disinterested in calls for a review of the planned reopening date until personal protective equipment are supplied to all schools. He tells me that since the group's petition to the court is scheduled to be heard on Tuesday, teachers and parents should not report to the schools until the case is resolved.
As the Educators Union of South Africa, we have instructed our legal team last week to file for an interdict, and we are happy that the court has set an urgent date for Tuesday, this coming Tuesday on the 2nd of June. But we are also calling upon our members not to go to school on Monday. And we are calling on all South African parents not to send their children to school on Monday. They must wait for the court to pronounce on Tuesday on what should happen. And we believe that the court will find in favor of us and many millions of learners and teachers.
Sifiwe, let me ask you this. Why is your group insistent on maintaining that your members do not go to the classroom as ordered by the government? What is the rationale behind this, what some people are describing as intransigent?
Firstly, new evidence shows that teachers are not immune to contract this virus. In the Western Cape province, we have more than 27 teachers already who have tested positive to the virus. We are saying, therefore, it is imperative that we are staying until the temperatures in September are higher than now in winter, so that this virus cannot be deadly as it is in winter. So we are not going to back down. We are backed by science and we are backed by evidence.
But if you were, a lot of people agree that the government has done well with restrictions to limit the spread of the disease and implemented other medical measures to stop the spread of the disease, and that this call on your members to defy the government order to reopen schools basically is politically motivated just to make the government and perhaps the president look bad. How do you respond to that?
As the Educators Union, we are a non-politically aligned teachers union. So we subscribe to no political party politics. We are more concerned about the lives of teachers and lives of our children at the moment. So any insinuation that this might have political things or interest is misplaced and needs to be displaced with all the contempt it deserves. We are saying the experts of the World Health Organization and the experts in the country have said this virus is deadly in winter. Therefore, we cannot risk sending our children and our teachers to fight this invisible enemy in winter. And whoever is saying this is political must think twice. We love our children. We don't want graves. We want our children.
Sifiwe, what do you say to those who are saying that the government is prepared to provide the PPEs that you spoke about and that all this you are doing is just, it doesn't make sense, they said, since students need to go and prepare to write exams for their future prospects?
We are saying the government started lockdown advising the nation that this virus is deadly. This virus is more spreading in cold environment, and we have evidence of Europe and America that indeed it happened. So we are saying now the virus is at its peak, at its deadly level in South Africa because we are in the winter. So we can't afford to send our teachers and children now. And the government started properly, but now because of economic interest that they are driving over our lives, now they want to end the lockdown. We are saying they can end the lockdown, but we are not going to be what you call guinea pig for them. And we are not going to be sacrificial land for them to open the economy. If they want to open their economy, fine, let them do it. But schools must remain closed until September.
Sifiwe Mpungose is General Secretary of Educators Union of South Africa. He spoke with me from Johannesburg. The Deputy Commissioner of the Lesotho Police says former First Lady Masaya Thabane will be arrested when she returns to the country. Paseka Moketi also says former Prime Minister Thomas Thabane is not immune from prosecution, as his defense lawyers had argued while he was in office. His remarks come after the appeals court revoked the former First Lady's bail. The police accused Mrs. Thabane of murdering the former Prime Minister's estranged wife, Lipolelo. Deputy Police Commissioner Moketi tells me that the police plan to seek extradition of the former First Lady if she fails to return to Lesotho.
Yeah, that is true following the court judgment yesterday that the bail that she was granted has been set aside.
So that paves the way for you to arrest her for the allegation that she had a hand in the murder of her rival?
Oh, yes. The only thing that we could not find her at her residence, and we were informed, even though that cannot be confirmed, that she's in the Republic of South Africa. She's with her husband, the former Prime Minister, where she's attending medical checkup.
Some people are suggesting that what happens if she doesn't return? Is there a policy where the police can request for extradition?
Oh, yes, we've got an agreement with the Republic of South Africa to extradite her in case she doesn't show up. But I'm of the view that she will ultimately arrive, and that if she doesn't, we'll have no choice but to invoke legal processes to get her arrested.
So where is the case now, if I may ask you, as the lead investigator of this case?
The case is complete. We are strongly pending the arrest of those suspects who are also in the Republic of South Africa. But that is the task to be performed by the Office of Director of Public Prosecutions to process the extradition papers.
Now, what happens to the Prime Minister? Because there were reports that there seemed to be a political solution for him to step down so the police will not press charges against him. Is this true?
Well, I don't think it is true that there's been an agreement that you will not be charged, because we are not part of that agreement in the first place. And I'm of the view that, in fact, to my knowledge, he has not been granted any immunity whatsoever. So you know, he's expected to appear. He's going to appear before the court anytime soon. I think we are waiting for the new government to settle and give them the report that we are intending to take him to court to be formally charged.
I remember his lawyer said he has immunity as the prime minister. Does that immunity, if I may ask you, since you are the investigator, cover him once he is out of office as well?
No, it doesn't. Even when he's still in the office, there is no such immunity.
Do you think the police have the backing of institutions in the country to carry out this prosecution without fear or favor, irrespective of the anticipated political pressure that could be brought bear on the police?
Well, you know, because we are an independent institution, we have been big, among others, the investigation of alleged crimes committed. And we have the view that we have that mandate which has to be performed or carried out without any fear or favor. But as regards other institutions, really, I cannot comment much about them. So if to say the recent Court of Appeal case actually brought some lied to us that the DPP actually took the side of the DPP, that is the director of our prosecution, took the side of the accused, where she was actually against us. She was protecting her in the sense that she appeared to us that she did not want her to be rearrested, or her bail that was granted, which we termed under unquestionable circumstances to be revoked.
DCP, if I may ask you, what is the message here to the people of the Kingdom of Lesotho, particularly with this case that you said has been completed?
What I can simply say is that the rule of law must prevail. And if a person is suspected of having committed any crime, it shall be the duty of the police officers to investigate such persons and bring them before the court of law to be formally charged and ultimately prosecuted. Unless the constitution of the Kingdom of Lesotho dictates otherwise, nobody is immune from prosecution in as far as we know, except His Majesty King.
Paseka Moketi is the Deputy Police Commissioner of Lesotho. He spoke with me from the capital, Maseru. A close ally of former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo says a cross-section of the population wants to see him return to the West African country. Jean-Gervais Tshidi, a prominent member of Gbagbo's opposition Ivorian Popular Front or FPI party, says his arrival will significantly boost reconciliation efforts within the country. His comments come after the International Criminal Court or ICC says the former president, who is currently being hosted by Belgium, can leave the European country after meeting certain conditions. Jean-Gervais Tshidi tells me that supporters of the party are excited about the prospects of the former president's return to Ivory Coast.
Well, we are expecting to come back home because the ICCC has completely released him from any restrictions to his freedom. So now, after being acquitted, the restrictions, the conditions on his liberation are now taken out. So we expect him to come back because the ICC has delivered his passport and his ID. And the decision made by the ICC says that he can go anywhere he wants, especially to the country, to any country member of the ICCC.
Now, so let me ask you, is there any specific preparations being done at the moment or plans being put together to welcome the former president if he decides to return home?
Well, for the time being, nothing as such. But we are waiting for him to call and tell us what to do. We just expressed our happiness on hearing that he can now travel and talk about politics. So that is the first thing. Now we are waiting for him to tell us what he is planning to do. And from that, we can also make our own plan.
There were suggestions that his presence in Ivory Coast could create political instability due to the circumstances that led to his prosecution at the International Criminal Court over allegations of destabilizing the West African country of Ivory Coast. Don't you think that his presence or his return could spark these concerns again?
Well, there is no reason at all to sustain such a suggestion. President Gbagbo was accused of crime against humanity, war crimes, and he has been acquitted. In Ivory Coast here, he has been accused of financial crimes during his ruling time. These are the facts. Now, I don't understand why anybody can say that his presence in Côte d'Ivoire could create problems or whatever in the country. There's no evidence to sustain such an affirmation. So what I want to say is that his presence, on the contrary, on the opposite, is being in Côte d'Ivoire will be a boost to the reconciliation process, because now we know that it is only Mr. Gbagbo, the President Gbagbo, who can call upon everyone in the country to go to a real and durable reconciliation in the country.
So does that mean that supporters of the former president are not concerned that the government could possibly press charges of financial crimes against him if he returns?
We are not concerned about that. Anyway, if the government is sure that what is the allegations can be sustained by any evidence, we are expecting them to make Mr. Gbagbo come to Côte d'Ivoire so that he can defend himself in the criminal court. This is how things go on. Now, we know, we think that Dr. Ouattara's regime should be more inspired and arrange Mr. Gbagbo's arrival in Côte d'Ivoire. That could be a good point for them.
But what do you say to people who say that Gbagbo's presence in Côte d'Ivoire will not boost chances of reconciliation as you enumerated, but will rather create unnecessary tension and deepen divisions within the country?
Mr. Gbagbo has made the demonstration that he is engaged in the process of reconciliation. And he has done something for that. He is the only protagonist of the crisis, of the Ivory crisis, who has taken the opportunity or taken initiatives to go further into the reconciliation process. Mr. Ouattara has been in power for 10 years now, and we are still waiting for the reconciliation to come to reality in Côte d'Ivoire. So Mr. Gbagbo, Mr. Ouattara, and Mr. Abidié were the three personalities who were in the crisis. In the beginning, Mr. Abidié and Mr. Ouattara were together, and they didn't achieve reconciliation. Now they are separated, and Mr. Gbagbo has received Mr. Abidié in Brussels, and the two persons have signed an agreement to go to reconciliation, work for reconciliation on the initiative of Mr. Gbagbo. So how can people say that a person like Mr. Gbagbo, who is working for reconciliation, even from his prison cell, can be accused of being probably or eventually the causes of trouble in Côte d'Ivoire? This is mere political speculation.
Jean-Gervais Chide is an ally of former Ivorian President Laurent Gbagbo and a prominent member of the opposition Ivorian Popular Front, or FPI, party. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Abidjan. In Nigeria, a new poverty alleviation program announced by President Muhammadu Buhari's government is drawing praise. Scheduled to begin in October, the Special Public Works Program forms part of the government's effort to decrease unemployment among the youth in the rural areas. Announcing the program, Festus Keyamo, the Minister for State Labor and Employment, says the government seeks to employ about 1,000 unemployed youths in every local government area for 3 months. Mohamed Bassa spokesperson for the Generational Citizens for Better Leadership Initiative, a civil society group, tells me if properly implemented, the new program will create jobs for the youth and sharply reduce the high unemployment rate in the rural areas.
Considering the uncertainties and all the rest, there's a need for government interventions this time more than ever before. And it's not something that is strange. It's something that even in America, during the time of the Great Depression, the then President FDR instituted such schemes. So we believe that it is a welcome development, and if applied with other interventions and other stimuluses, the economy will definitely pick up.
If it's taken off in October to employ people in the rural areas as the program is designed to do, or as spoken to by Mr. Festus Keyamo, the Minister of State for Labor and Employment, how significant an impact will this have in the rural areas, particularly the youth based in those areas?
It's a known fact that those in the rural areas are some of the worst hit by the poverty that has been in the land before now, as well as the current economic climate. They are the worst hit by it, because we have situations where, from our own interactions with people in the rural areas, we found that many of them who rely on their little farm produce, many of them are unable to go to the farms, because we have even invested to sell these produce. So it will have a far-reaching impact, especially for the part-time targeted at dwellers.
So what is your group going to do to help to ensure a success of this initiative?
Our own position is that we are a societal watchdog as a registered non-governmental organization. As a societal watchdog, we are there to ensure that there is accountability, there is transparency in the process, and that the beneficiaries are actually people who are supposed to benefit and not those who are sympathetic to the cause of one vested interest or the other, or one political party or the other. We are there to ensure that this thing goes across the board. It covers all Nigerians who are in need of such an intervention at this point in time.
What do you say to people that this is yet another attempt by the government to create yet another bureaucracy? Because the government, they said, federal government has not been effective in implementing measures and policies to alleviate poverty in Nigeria, which has seen a sharp increase in poverty in the rural areas. So this is yet another attempt which they said might not be effective at all. As a watchdog, what will be your role to ensure its effectiveness, if I may ask you?
Well, for starters, like I said before, I said that if this is applied alongside other stimuli, definitely the impact will be felt in the economy. So this cannot just be taken in isolation. However, the minister was very clear that it was going to be done with the National Directorate for Employment. Directorate have a specific mandate, which is to create employment and things like that for Nigeria. So we're going to be holding them to their words, and as well, we're going to ensure that that directorate is also working within the enabling law that creates the mandate that it has to deliver for Nigerians.
So looking forward, what should be the expectations of Nigerians in the rural areas, particularly since this program will be to their benefit? What should be their expectations and yours as well? And how do you intend to work with the government to actualize this vision of the government?
Yes, to the people in the rural areas, we think that the government belongs to them. And they also have to ensure that they do their part, because it's not meant to be a handout, you know, of cash transfer for the sake of transferring cash to people, that they are going to be tied to specific responsibilities on their part. So it's expected that they too should also ensure that they meet up to whatever is required of them within the rules of engagement in terms of this program. And also we expect them to also be accountability partners as well, and those of us who are in civil society. So if they see anything that is going wrong, they should also alert us, even as they're alerting the authorities, so that we can hold the authorities accountable. Because ultimately, every government that requires to buy the people to succeed. Because no matter how beautiful, fantastic your plans may be, if the people do not buy in and play their part, it will definitely fail.
Mohamed Bassa is the spokesperson for the Generational Citizens for Better Leadership Initiative. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. But first, UN and private aid agencies are scaling up assistance to thousands of people who have lost everything in a fire that engulfed their camp in Maiduguri, the capital of Eastern Nigeria's Borno State, a week ago. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
What was meant to be a festive occasion celebrating the end of Ramadan turned into a nightmare. On the eve of the Muslim festival of Eid al-Fitr, sparks from a cooking fireplace started a fire that spread throughout a camp housing 40,000 people who had fled Boko Haram violence. Two people died in the blaze. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees reports nearly 4,000 people, most of them women, lost all their goods. UNHCR spokeswoman Shabia Mantu says the fire in this makeshift settlement has destroyed their shelters, razed houses to the ground, and damaged other facilities.
UNHCR is working with authorities, aid agencies, and local partners to make sure that those affected receive shelter and other relief items, as people once again are being displaced outside and also inside the camp now. Many, including young children, are living under the open, basically living out into the open and without protection, but also needing immediate help, shelter, food, and clothing.
Nearly 300,000 people displaced by Boko Haram violence are living in organized and makeshift sites in and around Maiduguri. Mantu says the current tragedy is only the latest in a spate of fires that have broken out throughout the region in recent months. She says camps across northeast Nigeria are congested and shelters are too close together for safety.
With violence on the rise, the threat of COVID-19 also brings in new threats for internally displaced people living in overcrowded camps and settlements where physical distancing is impossible. In response, UNHCR is working with the UN Development Programme to expand several camps and build additional shelters.
Since the Boko Haram insurgency started in 2009, tens of thousands of people have been killed and 2.5 million have been displaced across the Lake Chad region. This number includes 1.8 million inside Nigeria and the rest in Cameroon and Chad. Despite numerous setbacks, Boko Haram remains a potent and dangerous force. The militant group has spawned other armed groups in the region, increasing violence. Aid agencies report thousands are fleeing for their lives every day. Those bearing the brunt of this ongoing conflict, they say, are young girls, old women, and aid workers. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A Sierra Leonean television host has launched an initiative to raise funds to help support the government's effort to stop the spread of the coronavirus in the West African country. Vicky Remo established the C19 Dignity Project over 3 weeks ago in a move to augment the effort of frontline workers in combating the disease. The initiative has so far raised over $38,000, which has been used to purchase what the group described as vital equipment, medication and hygiene supplies to hospitals and treatment centers. To learn more about the C19 Dignity Project, how it all started, and the prospects in achieving its objectives, I reached the founder of the group, television host Vicky Remo, in the Sierra Leonean capital, Freetown.
So about a month ago, a friend of mine who is a doctor at Sierra Leone Zone's largest referral hospital, Connaught Hospital in Freetown, made a Facebook post that if anybody wanted to know how hospitals were doing during this COVID pandemic, that they should go to those hospitals and ask them what they needed, because they would probably find that most of the most basic tools weren't there. And so the next day I went to the hospital and I asked them, what is it that you don't have? They gave me a tour of their infectious disease unit, which is now their COVID isolation center, to show me their needs. And basically what I saw were beds without medical tools. And they explained that the key risk there in an isolation center for COVID is that if you don't have medical tools for all the individual 12 beds, there's a possibility for cross-transmission. So I got on the phone and I started calling people to see if I could raise the funds to buy the medical tools that were needed.
Since you started raising funds in this effort to help fight the COVID-19 disease, how has been the responses from Sierra Leoneans?
It's been 4 weeks since we started this campaign, and while when I started, I really did believe that there were lots of individuals who would want to support our frontline health workers, I knew that. I believed it, but I didn't know that it would be to this scale. Sierra Leoneans, both at home and abroad, people in the private sector, individuals, people in organizations, associations of people, WhatsApp groups have been reaching out and making all kinds of donations. It really has been overwhelming. One of the most touching ones for me was a woman who reached out to me on Facebook that she's in Afghanistan. She's from Sierra Leone. She sent $100 via Western Union to her daughter who lives in Sierra Leone, and her daughter then sent it to us via mobile money. And she was just like, you know, I just really want to be a part of this because it's so important for us to be united at this time. So the support has really, it's been mind-blowing.
So Vicky, how do you ensure transparency and accountability in this fundraising drive so that people can feel confident to contribute as well as give them the necessary impetus to contribute to a worthy cause?
So one of the lessons that all of us here in Sierra Leone learn, me especially, is I saw that monies that were raised for Ebola relief did not go to the places we're supposed to go to. So when I started this fundraiser, I knew that being transparent and making sure that the public who are donating to this and the people who we want to raise funds for, that they should see, they should be able to track where the money's coming and where it's going. So I created a Google Drive, and every week we update what we've received and the facilities that we've spent them on and the items that we spent them on, just because it's very important for people to see that they can make an impact. And you're not going to believe that you're making an impact if you can't follow the money right down to the hospital facility where it's going. So that's how we're making sure that the public can monitor the funds that they're giving to us.
So Vicky, what are some of the institutions that have benefited from this drive, and how do people donate to the cause?
So far, we've been able to support 284 COVID treatment beds at 7 different facilities that include the Jue Hospital, Connaught Hospital, 34 Military Hospital, the Lungay Government Hospital in Potoka District in the north, as well as the COVID treatment facility for the prison, the central prison in Freetown. Tomorrow we're going to Bull, which is in the south of the country, and also to Kenema, which is in the east, to make additional medical deliveries. So they will also be benefiting because the virus has spread to almost every district in Sierra Leone. If people are interested in supporting this campaign, they can go to vickiremoe.com. That's www.vickiremoe.com. Or you can just search for adopt a COVID-19 treatment bed in Sierra Leone, and it should come up in your Google search.
Vicky Remo is a Sierra Leonean television host. She spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Athletics goes virtual. Athletics superstars, marathon icons, Eliud Kipchoge and Kenenisha Bekele, plus Uganda's world 10,000 meters champion Joshua Kiptegei and New York marathon champion Geoffrey Kamworor will take part in a worldwide relay marathon next month. All forerunners are managed by Global Sports Communications. The marathon will take place between June 6th and 7th and is open to all athletics fans worldwide. The Relay Marathon is an initiative of the NN Running Team and it's a virtual team relay marathon race where people around the world can form a team of four to cover the marathon distance. Each individual covers 10.5 kilometers, so the team completes a full marathon together alone. This allows participants to safely run solo in their own location while running in a team via virtual standings. Meanwhile, the Boston Marathon has been cancelled for the first time in its 124 years history because of the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. The race had initially been postponed from April 20th to September 14th. However, Boston Mayor Matty Walsh said the race could not be held this year because of public health fears. The event is the longest running major annual marathon in the world, having been held every year since 1897. Kenya's Lawrence Chirono and Wakanesha Begefa of Ethiopia won the men and women's races in 2019. Still in athletics, two-time Olympic 800 meters champion David Rudisha has been ruled out of training for up to 4 months after an ankle surgery in Eldoret. Rudisha, who intends to compete at his third Olympic Games next year, twisted his left ankle at his rural home in Kilgoris, Narok County in Kenya on May 19th. He's likely to be out for 12 to 16 weeks, although with coronavirus, this might not have much of an impact on serious competitions. The 31-year-old Kenyan, who is the 800 meters world record holder, has not competed since May 2017 because of recurrent back and knee injuries. In African football, the Tunisian Football Federation, FTF, has announced a roadmap for return to competitions in August. The Tunisia Football League has been suspended since mid-March 2020 due to COVID-19. The FTF proposed plan has now received the green light from the Tunisian authorities. The schedule set out by FTF will see games returning in August 2020 and the new 2020-2021 season kickoff is late October 2020. And on a sad note, Uganda's legend Jimmy Kirunda passed away on Monday, May 25th. According to the Federation of Ugandan Football, FUFA, the 70-year-old collapsed while walking in a Kampala suburb and was pronounced dead moments later. Kirunda was captain of the Ugandan national team that reached the final of the 1978 Africa Cup of Nations, losing to host Ghana. He also featured at the African Cup of Nations in 1974 and 1976 in Egypt and Ethiopia, respectively, during the 10-year period he captained the national team. Revered as one of the best players ever to have come out of Uganda, Kirunda featured for local clubs Express, KCCA, and Sports Club Villa, as well as a stint with Abu Dhabi Sports in the United Arab Emirates. He also served as Uganda coach between 1989 and 1996. And African football is also mourning the sudden demise of Cameroonian youngster Joseph Bouassi, who tragically passed away on the night of May 21st after suffering a cardiac arrest. The young Cameroonian was part of AS Roma's academy in 2016 after being scouted the previous year. He made his professional debut for Serie B side Vicenza while on loan from Roma in 2017, and prior to his passing, he played for a Romanian club, having signed for them in February. Bouassi arrived in Italy at age 16 alongside other child refugees from Cameroon. He was signed up by a refugee team in Italy, Liberi Nantes, where Roma scouted him and took him under the academy wings. And that's it for this edition of Netland Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Kashikiria, mwacha vimbe pichwa, wallahi kanipatia,
anastahili sifa. Chumba kizima chanukia, uturi kajifisha. Vidore nasimamia, ukingoni nafikishwa. Nani kosha mwili kwa maji ya madafu? Yendo kocha, nana nifunza kucheza rafu. Anichua tumbo la ngiri kwa mafuta ya karafu. Nikichoka, ana nikanda kwa mabarafu. Majam, majam, penzi lake lajam. Majam, majam, mahaba yake lajam. Majam, majam, penzi lake lajam. Majam, majam, mahaba yake lajam. Kifuani unipaka harua, mikono tende anazichambua, anilamba. Kitandani humwaga maua, mengine hata chembe siku anajua, antoa ushamba. Nanitake nini kwake, nyombe sipewe. Iwe kupama chake chake, chakwe mwenyewe. Mambo shagani mwake mwake, mangaka msewe. Libandike, tenzi kama gazeti walisome. Tuadabishe, sangara shombo vipweti tuamone. Nikila nilishe, chapati za alizeti ninone. Tuwafungishe, midomo uzi simenti tuashone. Nani kosha mwili kwa maji ya madafu? Yendo kocha, nana nifunza kucheza rafu. Anichua tumbo la ngiri kwa mafuta ya karafu. Nikichoka, nana nikanda kwa mabarafu. Majam, majam, penzi lake lajam. Majam, majam, mahaba yake ajam. Majam, majam, penzi lake lajam. Majam, majam, mahaba yake ajam.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Mpuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a man does not test the depth of a river with both legs. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.